from Toronto will be in. David, tell us about it. Hi.
We're going to hear the first of four parts of Bob's radio play. And there goes the transmitter reading. I love not having to do that anymore. But this is the first of four parts of a radio play called Who's Forgotten Furry Lint? And Bob will take your telephone calls starting sometime after 7 o'clock.
Okay. That's it.
But it's widely known here.
Let me give you the title of the book. It's beginning to sound like Mae Russell's World Watches, but it's from McGill University. This is the title on the front cover. I'm not reading a table of contents. What links the Mafia, the Vatican, the Moonies, the CIA, the cocaine barons, the banks, and you to hot money and the politics of debt?
What does?
Well, it has to do with flight capital and the interconnections of these people, but the point is that I was years ahead of these people in making the connections of events that were not separate from each other. That's what makes me unique, is that, and now the other authors are catching on. When I was the first one and the only person on the air now, I'm starting my 17th year, doing an hour a week of these interconnections. Now, if you've heard one broadcast or two, you can't come to a conclusion. It's like catching a train from L.A. to New York. You stop through different cities.
That was a sudden cutoff. We've been listening to the first of four parts of a radio play by Bob Dobbs, Who's Forgotten Furry Lint? And we'll be hearing the second part sometime in the middle of March, third part sometime in the middle of May, and the fourth part sometime in the middle of July, if all goes well. This is KPFK Los Angeles. It's 7:03 in the morning, going on 7:04. My name is David Porter, and the program is Genesis of a Music. I'd like to thank Bruce Holohan for sitting in for me for the last couple of weeks. I've been tending to some family business, and he'll be here again next week. I'll be back in February. And we're going to be going to our live phone-in show with Bob Dobbs. We have one small problem. We cannot take conference calls. So after Bob and I get done doing our morning wrap, what we'll do is we'll ask for your phone calls. You won't be able to talk to Bob. This is going to be real discarnate. You'll be able to ask a question. Bob will hear it, but then you're going to have to go to your radio to hear Bob's response. So let's just try this out. Good morning, Bob.
Hello, Dave.
Oh, you're there. You know, this is pretty funny. I have about four phone numbers for you this morning. I guess the Pinks are really at it this morning.
What do you mean, four numbers?
I have two actives and a couple of unactives. I guess your agents were worrying that the Pinks were trying to track you, and they gave me several to try.
Ah, okay.
I know you may even have to move around during this radio show.
That's right. It's January 22nd. That's 1:22.
Well, we just heard the first hour of this intriguing radio program, Who's Forgotten Furry Lint? Now, what was the impetus behind your doing this?
Well, I have to give credit to Bob Marshall. My project, my drama is called Hand Signals for the Blind. But my colleague Bob Marshall has one subsidiary operation of it called Who's Forgotten Furry Lint? And it's something he put on in Toronto in 1988 on CKLN, about 4 hours. And it was a collage of all the different sources of information that he used when he was on the air in Toronto from 1984 to 88. And my interpretation of what he attempted is that he's predicting almost the holeopathic retrieval. The holeopathic retrieval is the Manipian infomercial. And the Manipian infomercial shows the mind in action, and today we've extended our mind with the information environment, so it shows the information environment in action. Now, the holeopathic retrieval on the mass level is people like Howard Stern, Rush Limbaugh, and President Clinton. They are retrievals of mythic stages and private attempts to balance what they see as an unbalanced media ecology system. So Bob Marshall took particular holy offices that I introduced him to, like Marsh McLuhan, Frank Zappa, Lyndon LaRouche, Mae Brussel, Dr. Beter, and presented them over 4 hours, hoping that the listener could see the wrenching directions each influence, each source of information moves us into, and also trying to comment on the fact that these are people who he thought had something to say, but they're operating in an environment where nobody is listening, or that every other information source, banal or esoteric, is canceling out them as well as being canceled out. So I think the flyer says something like, there are those who have nothing to say, and then there are those who have something to say, but both suffer under the problem of the fact that everything has disappeared.
Let me ask you a question. Now, you're describing these people as holeopathic retrievals. What does that make you?
I'm the Tetrad manager extraordinaire. I'm the one who's aware of the process of the ground at this point, which is 1990 to 2020. If you look in the CD chart from 1977 to 1990,
which
you had
CD
the phases
chart?
Of the mythic stage.
Which CD chart?
In Bob's Mediacology Squared.
The second one.
Yeah, there's that, and then there's that's the preliminary chart, and then the first CD has a chart from 1840 to 2020. But they both overlap, both charts. And when the mythic stage, the operation of the mythic stages collapsed in 1990, the most popular expression of that was the Berlin Wall, then you had the fact that everything disappeared accelerated to a third degree or a fourth degree of geometric intensity or implosion. So you had tiny mythic stages represented by one person who the audience sees as representing them, but allows that person to do all the work of representing them, and the audience cynically and satirically allows that person to run amok over all the other media that they see themselves in competition with, the other mythic stages. So from 1977 to 1990, the mythic stages actually was a situation where the audience passively accepted mass media images like Ronald Reagan. But now you have a situation where Ronald Reagan, who represented the American government, so to speak, he does not, in the decentralized post-mythic stage situation, an institution finds his hard, a mass media historical institution finds it hard to be represented. So particular individuals who offer information or an infomercial, as Rush Limbaugh and Howard Stern do every morning they go over the news, they represent a reaction, a cynical, humorous, and righteous reaction to the information swell that everybody is swimming in. So holeopathic retrieval is the second degree of the mythic stage represented by one individual. Now, Bob's Mediacology is a satire on the process of holeopathic retrievals, which I understand Tom Touché influenced Nelson Thal to make the album that way. But it is true that I am the Tetrad manager that is aware of the process we're in today. So I'm the hidden holeopathic retrieval because I'm aware of the process. But I wouldn't say that I'm just a holeopathic retrieval. I'm interpreted as a holeopathic retrieval, but I'm aware of all the processes from 1840 to 2020, so I can jump from one era to another. So I can be involved in assassinations, which is the old 1948 Big Brother apparatus, or I can be involved in very slick software operations on the information level.
Well,
it came in with the computer age.
At the risk of you being an assassination of this radio program, you kind of have evaded the question of what are you perceived to be a holeopathic retrieval.
Right. Or as the CD is presented by Tom Touché. Remember, that's an interpretation of me, just as Reverend Stang's Church of Subgenius is an interpretation of my work. So the interpretation sees me as a manipian satire on all the other holeopathic retrievals, from Camille Paglia to Gerrymander to President Clinton to Hillary Clinton, to all the major media figures who people invest such emotional energy in. I was asked in a recent show, do I have compassion? And I said, yes, I wouldn't be doing these shows with you, Dave, if I didn't have compassion. So the compassionate evocation or mood that a service image, a holeopathic retrieval as a service image like Rush Limbaugh provides, is what I'm doing by interacting with the audience. But there is a level of satire and self-consciousness in doing this.
Okay, what's Bob Marshall a holeopathic retrieval of?
He's not a holeopathic retrieval.
Yes, he is.
He was a journalist in Toronto, and he began to see the problems as a journalist of putting out May Brussels information the Executive Intelligence Review and Sherman Skolnick and the whole spectrum of political muckraking, he saw how his work was constantly canceled out. And there really was no audience for it. There may be a tiny audience, but it's like you, Dave. You're like Bob Marshall. You want to change and influence people through KPFK, and you have to deal with the problem of the media swill in the global theater. So Bob Marshall started to dialogue with me in the later 80s and get a hint of the problem he was up against. And in the inspiration of that, he put on Who's Forgotten Furry Lint. Now, Furry Lint, for him, relates to Larry Flint, because Bob Marshall got involved with Mae Brussel, who was the advisor to Larry Flint when he ran for president in 1983-84. And he had Rebel magazine coming out. And Bob Marshall was behind the scenes with Mae, helping Larry Flint, just as Mae Brussel guided Frank Zappa through his hearings in Washington in 1985.
Yeah, and they're both dead now.
Beg your pardon?
They're both dead now.
Well, that's what's interesting. A lot of the holy offices are dead, but that's another story. We can go into that a little later. The thing is, so Bob Marshall decided that Larry Flint represented something. He tried to influence journalism or the presidential reality in 1984, and of course, he ended up in a mind control center. And so he was brushed like a piece of lint, a piece of furry lint. It was just removed from the fabric and face of America, of American media life. And so that's happened to too many people. It's happened to all the holy offices. In some way, Americans don't realize the great composer they have in Frank Zappa. So Frank Zappa suffers the furry lint syndrome.
How come that hasn't happened to me yet?
Well, you haven't become a major media figure.
Well, thanks, Bob.
You do have to do that a little bit.
No, you may not know this, but Bob Marshall was a guest on this program some years ago.
He was?
Yeah.
What did he talk about?
Mae Brussel. It was just after she died.
Oh, yes, yes. In 1988.
I don't know if he told you that.
I don't think so. He never mentioned it. See, that was in October 88, just after he did this show, Who's Forgotten Furry Lint? And any of the holy offices can be a furry lint. And I didn't have much access to Bob Marshall after that. So that was maybe the last time I heard of him, when he did Who's Forgotten Furry Lint, and I didn't know he was involved with Mae Brussel.
Yeah,
later.
A lot of people have lost contact with Bob Marshall.
Yeah.
I have a question. Now, you keep bringing up Lyndon LaRouche. Now, let's see, how can I put this? My impression of Lyndon LaRouche is that his foundation is on fact, but his superstructure seems to be way off the deep end. In some ways, he's kind of like you, Bob.
I would say that it's for me, it's the reverse, that LaRouche's conceptual superstructure is brilliant. He's almost a philosophical genius. And I recommend anybody read his book, The Science of Christian Economy, where he runs through the history of philosophy and expresses his enthusiasms, his reservations, and actually a quite integrated retrieval of the Western visual space, alphabetic, geometric, Western tradition. And that book is something that runs through a lot of his themes, and you'll be amazed at the depth of his conceptual analysis. So his superstructure to me is important. And then you said his factual basis may be relevant. I think since facts are fictions, since they come from the word fact comes from factio, to make, so it's very hard to determine the consistency of a fact. So I would say LaRouche's operation as factual is not 100% true. I would say every holy office is a half-truth.
I said that was the perception I had.
Right. Now, every holy office is a half-truth, and a half-truth is a lot of truth for most people, all right? Now, you're asking me to say something more about LaRouche. I do have something to say.
Well, don't let me stop you.
Okay. I think it's very significant that that Lyndon LaRouche will be released next week on January 26th, and the fact that Frank Zappa died in December, because, you know, as an aesthetic theorist, I pose Lyndon LaRouche and Frank Zappa as competing conceptualists of the role of music in society. Now, music is obsolete, and music as an art form is something that doesn't have the effect that it used to have in the 19th and 18th century.
Well, even in the first half of this century, you know, one could even argue from a musicological standpoint that the 19th century didn't really end until 1918.
Yes, and then after that, music was obsolete, and various parts of the avant-garde tried to incorporate an intuition of that.
Well, no, wait. You could also say, especially as a scholar of the works of Ives, one could say that music didn't really become obsolete until 1945, and we know what date that also celebrates.
Yes, I would say that both the dates can be interpreted as accurate. I would accept 1918 or 1945, even 1977. But I think that Frank Zappa...
Well, wait, why 1977? What happened then?
Well, that's when all media expressions, the mass media, disappeared. And we've been in the mythic stage or hologramic after-image since 1977.
I see.
So the thing I wanted to say about Zappa and LaRouche is that everything is obsolete now and disappeared, but so is obsolescence. So you have all these retrievals, either mythic stage retrievals or holopathic retrievals. And I see Lyndon LaRouche, he retrieves the visual space basis of music, and Frank Zappa retrieves another basis of music. And I have in my CD notes here an expression of this. The modern artist, this is on the first CD, I say in my memo to Prince Charles, the modern artist today has to at least feign or fake a strategy of mixed corporate media programming. The elite managers of our global theater, that's the tetrad managers like myself, consider this all in a day's work. And the floating, discarnate citizens of this theater must respond 24 hours a day to the massage of this complex sensory programming. The comprehensive artist must be prepared to mime this situation from all points of view, either satirically, joyously, mournfully, or preferably all three. Two examples are Frank Zappa and Lyndon LaRouche. And then I have in brackets, Frank was recently overheard discussing changes to downtown Los Angeles with Cheech, of Cheech and Chong, and LaRouche is forever running for president of the United States. Both are mixed corporate media positions. The mixed corporate media artist would mime the sensory technological massage symbolically. For example, Frank Zappa kineticizes visual and acoustic effects. And to prove that, you go back to the very first piece of work that Frank did when he was in his teens. He made a film called Motion. And motion is kinetic space. And then in 1969 in Hot Rats, he says, this movie for your ears. Now, movies are extensions of kinetic space. So this kinetic space for your ears. So Frank Zappa, in a role supposedly as a musician, kineticized visual, that's Western alphabetic and print effects, as well as acoustic or radio oral effects. Whereas Lyndon LaRouche acousticizes, since Lyndon LaRouche basically had a radio era bias, he's sort of like a 50s guy, Lyndon LaRouche acousticizes visual and kinetic effects. Now his kinetic effects is his effort to reinvigorate the Rust Belt, the old hardware industry, steel, and farming and agriculture and these things. He always had that in the program, but it was under a radio bias, a radio sense of organizing American society, sort of epitomized by FDR. So Lyndon LaRouche acousticizes visual, alphabetic and geometry, and kinetic effects, whereas Marshall McLuhan tactilized both the visual, acoustic, as well as the kinetic effects. So what within music, as one of these minor disciplines within a mixed corporate media programming that the modern artist has to mime, the question is, does Frank Zappa offer the strategy of merging with the effects of the disappearance of music and the effects of the electric age, or should he provide a counter-irritant to that, which I think Lyndon LaRouche does? In other words, Lyndon LaRouche revitalizes Beethoven with new conceptual vigor. And looking at which way the rock drug culture goes versus the executive culture or scientific culture of LaRouche, in the long run, from 100 years from now, we're going to have to decide which artist, LaRouche or Zappa, within the music world, had the more healthy, holistic agenda for the discipline of music as a mythic stage retrieval.
Well, I think it's hands down Frank Zappa, because it's sort of the old Platonic argument about... You know, Plato thought that musicians and other artists should be made subservient to... it's kind of a communist philosophy, you know, or a Maoist philosophy where you ride a bicycle and wear a single uniform for the rest of your life.
Yes. Now, remember, LaRouche was a great not a Neoplatonist, a Platonist. Now, Frank was an Aristotelian in the sense he relied on sensory empirical data and his intuition. The Platonist is more abstract and visually biased. I think the Electric Age favors the Aristotelian view right now, but the 20th century itself could flip into a Platonic preference in the 21st century, say by the year 2020, 2050.
Well, this is.
So, what were you saying about Plato?
Well, I'm just what you've said also reminds me that when I was studying music, it was very Platonic because the whole idea was that it didn't really matter what music sounded like. You had to make sure that there was understandable form and order, and it was really as if music was written to be analyzed rather than listened to. And the only good music was music that could be perfectly analyzed and nailed down.
Yeah, now LaRouche is partly like that, but he basically says great music enhances the attention span and the powers of concentration, which leads to your own conceptual inspiration and leading to scientific or artistic discoveries. If you put the proper prolonged attention span evoked by Beethoven, say, then you are being creative. So LaRouche kind of makes it more appetizing, what you just said. So there is that tradition. Now, Frank and the Frankfurt School of Music or Stravinsky, what would you say they are? They're opposite of that?
No. Well, Stravinsky later in his life began to get into this...
laws.
Yeah, although the Second Viennese School, who Arnold Schönberg is representative of, he even would get to the point where he would deliberately violate his rules for acoustic reasons, and it kind of upsets a lot of people who come around and hoping they can basically divorce themselves and not have to use their ears. And when Schönberg is the great lawgiver and he violates his own laws flagrantly and gets away with it, it does kind of throw a monkey wrench into the
Well, that's where he's intuiting the obsolescence of music as tactile, the electric tactile space takes over. And so I think these early 20th century artists intuited the obsolescence of music, and he was beginning to see the canceling out effect of tactility. But once one understands the tactile ground to that, then one isn't unconsciously responding to its effects, and you actually can sort of be reactionary and go back and create music within the discipline, ignoring the fact that within society it is canceled out. So I think that's what Frank did. Frank went back. He didn't totally agree with the minimalist and other directions of the avant-garde tradition. He kept his distance, and he sort of went back and tried to work within certain established forms. And
well,
that's where I think he intuited, I'm going to be a composer, I'm going to be a musician, and he always had this indifference, it's only for your entertainment. I'm going to do it for my own curiosity, but I'm going to work within the tradition of music before it was canceled by tactility.
Well, it's also, I see a parallel between Zappa and Ives in the sense that both composers come across these ideas of creating laws, and they will create little laws just to help them, writing a particular situation in a particular piece, but then they don't stick to it when the situation demands something else. In fact,
when the ground changes.
Yeah, speaking of the 12-tone row, there was one piece where Ives anticipated, when Ives was doing his experimentation, the Viennese composers, Berg, Webern, and Schönberg, were writing some of the most free music in all of Western history. It wasn't until like a decade later that they began to use this idea of a hierarchy of the 12-tone system, and they each applied it differently. But what Ives wrote about this system was it's an artificial process. Any unmusical student with a slide rule can do it, and it's not as natural as a big, mushy ballad. But for the purpose that he used it in that one passage of that one piece, it was completely appropriate.
Yes. I was involved with Schönberg and these people because I was born in Paris in 1922, and I was around the scene thanks to my father and his associates in the 30s and 40s, so I had direct access to these people. So I'm fully aware of the accuracy of what you're saying.
Yeah, and of course, after the it's funny that after the atomic age begins, you see the influence of the Second Viennese School made manifest in the movement called total serialism, which is something like not what you eat for breakfast, although it may go snap, crackle, and pop. It's an idea of you have to justify everything on basis of a rule, even the dynamics and the instrumentation, and even like what finger you use on what key.
Right. Now, that's what Daniel Shore wrote an appraisal of Frank Zappa for the L.A. Times after he died, and he mentioned something that's never been talked about. He said that Frank regarded music as science. Now, Bob Marshall's great interview with Zappa, it's about 70 pages long. Bob Marshall tried to get Frank to talk about that, and some of the principles are evoked. But the fact that Uncle Meat, as the liner notes of that album said, was an evil scientist, Frank never really talked about that. It was never brought out in interviews through the years, though he did make one interesting statement at the end of his life on a radio show in North Carolina in about June 1993, where he would like to talk to Stephen Hawking and propose that I think it was something that mass can be altered and that you can change a proton into an electron, something like that. Now, he wanted to talk to a major homeopathic retrieval of physics, Stephen Hawking, and talk about science, and he got cut off. The caller didn't pursue that point, and it's too bad because there's a lot of the scientific metaphor, as Marshall said, Marshall McLuhan, today under the tactile effects of the satellite, art as a discipline moves toward science, and science moves toward art. And I don't think Frank was completely aware of that. He just instinctively followed that path. But I can predict, as Tetrap manager, that within a couple of years, Bob Marshall will do part two of his interview with Frank Zappa, in 2 years, even though Frank Zappa's dead. I'll leave that to titillate Bob Marshall's fans.
Well, just as an aside here, something that just occurred to me you may not know about, and we're talking about musicians. In the 1920s, Edgar Varèse, Zappa was a big fan of his, he produced about one miniature work a year in the 20s. And towards the end of the 20s, he was imagining a piece called The Astronomer.
Yeah.
And the for the listeners who don't know this, you might know this, but for the listeners who don't, the theme is the astronomer hears a message from space, 1, 2, 3, and he answers it, 5, 7, 11. I think that's, they're all prime numbers.
Right.
And the people of the world get extremely upset and rail against the astronomer and threaten to destroy him, but beating them to it, a beam from outer space comes and vaporizes the astronomer. And then at the end, all the lights in the theater were to be turned on the audience, blinding them.
Well, isn't that, would you say that Stockhausen has followed that extraterrestrial fascination?
Well, yeah, but Stockhausen does it without having any fun.
Okay. He takes it serious. In a documentary
Stockhausen
on Frank,
thinks he's
there
another Beethoven.
A lot of quotes with Stockhausen, I think, about his interest in Sirius and intergalactic stuff. But I would say that's just on my chart in the... In the two charts in the CDs, you have the universal government stage from 1960 to 1977. Now, that is the effect of the computer, which swallows the whole universe and starts to create a fascination with extraterrestrial communication, and extraterrestrial communication becomes possible, as we're now witnessing, well after 1977, the crop circles are being done by entities from the Bootes galaxy. But you're right, the musician is getting interested in science, and he's getting interested in the more cataclysmic, catastrophic effects of science when we make contact with beings who have amazing technology. Well, so Varèse and these guys were intuiting, like proper antennae artists, were intuiting the post-1945 social situation.
Well, before I go on to my next subject, let me just... Frank mentions in several interviews that he can't imagine why Varèse sat in his apartment for 20 years from the late 30s through the early 50s not composing anything. Actually, Varèse did, but he'd tear it all up. In the mid-30s, he tried to contact Bell Laboratories about creating electronic instruments, and Bell, of course, you know, laughed at the idea.
I think my father was involved with laughing at Varèse.
Well, and Varèse basically got very frustrated, and from about 1935 on, with the exception of a commissioned solo flute work, which is a typical
Varèse. Well, I think the parallel is with Duchamp.
You know, well, he didn't do anything in music until the 50s, and then he came forth with a piece that combines electronics and live instruments. It's like when he could get the electronics, he then could reconcile himself to the traditional instruments.
Right. But think of the parallel with Duchamp.
Well, Duchamp got bored with that painting. He worked on the large glass for, 15 years? And got in 1965, apparently he actually did add some details and said it was completed to a drawing of the large glass.
Right. But both artists were great in the sense they realized the obsolescence of the traditional discipline of art, of music or art. And they were trying to contemplate, and part of it was to incorporate silence with John Cage. He took the ball and ran with. I mean, Duchamp, and then put on a public stance of silence.
Well, also he puts the painting on glass, which means that whatever you see through the glass becomes the background, and it constantly changes. And
right,
it's the idea of John Cage's silent piece.
The glass is an interesting. That's the mirror, and the mirror is an analogy that Marshall McLuhan used. One of his earliest essays was called "The Analogical Mirrors." The mirror is in the interval between visual space and light through or acoustic space. So if you have a mirror which has a reflection, then you have visual space, the alphabet, in the Western tradition. But if you have a glass that's see-through, then you're getting light through in the electric oral sensibility. So is Duchamp's glass a see-through?
Well, I know when it was shattered, he only replaced one portion of it, and he carefully reassembled the rest of it as it was, and he said then that the breaks in the glass, since they were very artistically appealing visually, he said they are now part of it.
Yeah.
It's kind of a John Cage aesthetic where the sounds you hear in the room are part of the music as well as the noises intentionally made.
Right. The privileging of the pure reflective mirror was obsolesced by the new acoustic and tactile retrieval, so the shattered glass, the shattered reflective mirror was incorporated in his light through glass performance. So,
by the way,
correct.
By the way, Bob.
Aesthetic accuracy like science.
I don't know if you're aware of this, Bob, but one of the last formal paintings that Duchamp did, I think it was 1918, it was commissioned, and it was supposed to sit above a large doorway, and it has, you know, it has a painted tear, but the safety pins are real. It has a bottle brush in it as well. The title in French is an abbreviation of a phrase meaning "you bore me."
Yeah. That's the beginning of information overload, which, you know, the kids of the 80s became what Andy Warhol called hyperbored. They incorporated both conditions, hyperkinetic movement obsession and bored at everything that happened as they moved.
Do you think this is a precursor of Beavis and Butthead?
No, but I'd say that the bored aspect is the tribal deadpan. The tribal man has a very impassive deadpan face. It's full of perception and awareness, but it's called a cool response to the environment. So people were starting to take the effects of the telegraph and telephone and radio in that early part of the 20th century and adopt the facial pose of the tribal deadpan. That's not the visual man's face. The visual man's face is not perceptive, but it is animated. As Marshall used to say, American faces had the curious baby face quality, and that's because they would wear their private face out in public, whereas the British and the European would put on a corporate voice, a corporate mask, when they went out in public. And that's why there's that antipathy between the British and Americans, because the British have this corporate voice, and the American has a private voice.
Well, the trouble with America versus someone like just a European in general outlook is that America basically is proud of being stupid and has no class consciousness.
You mean stupid in relation to what, though?
Living in a state of denial.
Yeah, I would say that is insisting on private space in a world where private spaces have been obliterated, and it favors the retribalization of the world, and the American is stupid in his persistence of maintaining a private identity in relation to the mixed corporate media's tribal identity. That's the stupidity. But that's a cultural thing. Just like tribal, let's say all third world cultures or African cultures or Asian cultures are putting on and feeling the favoritism that the electric media does give to tribal identity, and they're sort of merging with that corporate effect, with that electric effect, and feeling their tribal identity celebrated and retrieved, but they don't know that that's obsolesced by VCRs, answer machines, and private computers and virtual reality, which will emphasize electric autonomy, the super angel, the solitudinous individual, bypasses all cultures. So
yeah.
There is hypocrisy on both the north and the south side, or the east and the west.
Well, this is why I don't need a car. I have a fax machine. What am I going to do, drive to Europe?
That's right. You don't need a car. That's ancient technology, just like movies are the next best thing to a car is a movie, and a movie is pretty obsolete today. So nothing is obsolete.
Well, anyone can make one.
Yeah.
You know, one more thing about Lyndon LaRouche before, and we will be taking your phone calls in just a couple of minutes. The number is 818-985-5735 or 985-KPFK. But I'll explain how we're going to do that in just a second. One of the other things I liked about Lyndon LaRouche is he did not advocate a total media fast. He just advocated being selective, and what he basically outlined is most of the crap that passes for television these days, which is why I think nothing's better than to have the TV on and to have C-SPAN on, because basically I don't have to watch it. It's radio with pictures.
That's right.
And it's great because these guys are actually influencing my life, and I might as well know what they're up to.
Yes. The thing about LaRouche is that he really was the opposite of McLuhan. I mean, Marshall felt that computers were changing our psyches and satellites were doing this and that to us. He tried to give the causes to these effects. And LaRouche would call McLuhan a media fetishist, is that he emphasized too much the administrative apparatus of information stories. That's what LaRouche would call the computer environment. Whereas LaRouche said the real breakthroughs are in the hardware energy sources, and that fusion that's coming is going to really allow the whole world to feed itself. We're going to have desktop fusion. So he emphasized what was called in philosophy efficient causality, the hardware things that gave us energy and shelter, whereas Marshall emphasized formal causality, which was the effects of communication and language. Both are probably extreme aspects, and I try to relate them and show their own values and disservices in the book Phatic Communion with Bob Dobbs, which a copy is on its way to you, Dave. And this is the thing, that there is a half-truth in LaRouche.
Well, you know, one of the nice things about C-SPAN is, like KPFK, it has no commercials to get in my face like a grasshopper. And by the way, the people who are going to call in this morning, I hope you're going to remember this show, starting the fun drive at the end of February, beginning of March, and also when Bill Mitchell is on in 2 weeks from now. Well, we're going to try and take your phone calls. We can't do conference calls. You can call us at 818-985-5735, but it's going to be very discarnate because I'm going to have to put Bob on hold, put you on. Then
but I can hear them.
You'll hear them. Bob will hear you. Then I'll have to take you, the caller, off the air and put Bob back on. So let's.
And I'll give a pause so they can turn the radio on.
Yeah, and by the way, it'll take, after I punch the button, it takes about a second for you to come on the air. So let's try this out. This is very experimental. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Bob Dobbs. This is your friend, Robert Anton Wilson, contacting you from the universe next door. I have a question about your friend and mine, occult sugar daddy Aleister Crowley. Over here in the other continuum, I have always seen images of Aleister Crowley, but I've never heard his voice. And up until a few weeks ago, a friend of mine presented me with an underground CD, and I guess it was of occult daddy Crowley doing an incantation, and this was some OTO archive bootleg. And well, my question is, why does Aleister Crowley sound like such a fag? And I'll let you answer, Bob. I'll get off.
Yeah, I think a lot of us will get off on that one. maybe he sounded like a bassoon. Bob, what do you say?
Okay, Dave, I'm on.
Yes.
Okay, I heard that question, that statement. It's great to hear from the real Robert Anton Wilson. He called in on the first show and the second show. I was wondering where he'd been since then. If he missed those shows, he can get them from 310-306-7330. There were some good shows in September, July, and November. But Aleister Crowley, who I knew, he sounded exactly, not when he was chanting, he sounded exactly like the person you hear at the beginning of Furry Lent, which you heard today. A man named Garrett Dean. Now, Garrett Dean is a combination of Aleister Crowley and Oscar Wilde. And the voice of Crowley is exactly replicated by Garrett Dean, who lived, Garrett Dean was born, in 1907 or so and died, in November this year, this past year. But another person, Dave Worster, who has spoken on this show, been part of our show, he has explained that as one moves into spiritual dimensions, he has channeled this, that you will activate the narcissistic, feminine side, you want to use Jungian terms, and you will naturally, a male, will incorporate a feminine thing as he integrates his left and right hemispheres and goes into the spiritual daimon. And I think that's why there is, to use the term, a faggish intonation. But I think Crowley didn't always sound like that. He sounded like Garrett Dean. So, Dave, you can play Garrett Dean if you want to show these people what Crowley sounded like. Do you think I answered the question?
I think you did. Let's try another call. Hold on. And you're on the air.
Yeah. It's been a great pleasure to tune into Bobbing for Apples here early in the morning for quite some time. I wanted to ask Bob, how did he think that the average person should use Finnegan's Wake and maybe even the Media Fast or Bob's Media Ecology as a self-discovery tool in order to, like, experience their own discorporation and tuning in? And how much was this type of idea printed in the kind of media iconography that's represented by, like, Hugh Hefner and his leisurely lifestyle? And I don't mean just his pipe and Bob has some interesting music, because I know I can't talk to him here on your new format. We want to thank him for giving us your time, and tell him that everyone down here in Venice says, howdy.
Okay, well, hang up, and like I say, this is not a new format. This is just we have a technical flaw this morning. Bob?
Okay. I think that person called in several shows ago. At the very end, I couldn't answer. That person, I heard the tape of the show after, and it's a very good question about fitting his wake. That's a key question. So either this person is picking up that previous caller's point, or it is the same person. I applaud him for calling back, and thanks for the kudos from Venice. The thing about fitting his wake is to go to page 52, and in the middle of the page, you see the line, which I've said before, television kills telephony and brothers broil. The eyes demand their turn. Let them be seen. What Joyce did, the amazing thing he did, is he created, in retrospect, a holopathic retrieval of visual space or of the book. He retrieved the book in a post-book world. The book does not have a constituent active grounding basis in society. It doesn't mold us as much as the new environment. So how do you make a book that could at least approximate a counter-irritant to the electric tactility, the acoustic and tactile bias? You make a book that has all the effects of the TV environment in the content and has the depth awareness of tribal man and mystical man and Gnostic man or women, any particulars there, Gnostic humankind. All that is contained as content, and you can look at the electric environment with your eye. At the same time, you can speak it out loud and use your ear. It is comprehensively exploiting all your senses in an integrated fashion, so that Finnegan's Wake is the aspirin, the enema, and better than Playboy. Did he mention Hugh Hefner, Dave?
Yes, he did. He wanted to know something about besides Hugh's pipe.
What is the meaning of Hefner?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Hefner
like
is. That's approximately the image that Stang interpreted of me. I mean, it's not exactly Hefner, but you could see that Hefner and his consumer slack that he had, which was a replay of the passive consumer of the 19th century, that was a limited retrieval, mythic stage, and wouldn't have staying power into the 21st century. But Stang emphasized one part of me, and that is the Hugh Hefner side, in general terms. But you have to understand that the Tetrad manager is a very active person. He uses his senses not in consuming, but in producing. I have to make sense, not match sense. I'm not passive. I'm active. And I'm active in the way of tactility and creating and moving, like Marsh McLuhan as a satellite conductor, the whole mixed corporate media environment. I'm moving the forms of it, whereas Hefner consumed the content. And the ultimate content fixation for males is women. And human beings, the anthropomorphic form, is always the content of all media. So that's what Hefner kind of emphasized, and he also emphasized the mechanical bride. So, but that's Hugh Hefner. Back to Finnegan's Wake, is that Finnegan's Wake is the aspirin, the enema, the whole, it's a medicinal operation to balance and include the tactile effects, but also to give your eye some slack. So the Finnegan's Wake gives the eye slack, and that's a form of personal media ecology. Now, the other genius of media of Finnegan's Wake is it also lays out the strategy for corporate media ecology, which is what I try to explain.
Okay. You know, boy, I hope we have these many calls in the fund drive. You know, I mean, I know some of you callers are out there don't have much money, but at least if you can't give us money during my slot, at least write letters to the general manager and program director about this show. Okay, I'm going to go to another call. Hold on, Bob.
Discussing.
Well, we're discussing Finnegan's Wake, media ecology, and the discarnate itself, and the effect of media on the population since 1945.
Can I make a viewpoint?
Sure.
I think the media, they ought to be boycotted. They ought to be, they're making this life, they're introducing lifestyle, they're introducing more and more product on the market for people to rely and depend on, making everybody's life complicated. It's now time for everybody to throw those televisions out on the street. I don't have a TV. And that's all they feed you. It's like, especially the news, they embedded fear and paranoia amongst the public. That's why the society is like people are so paranoid among each other. And I think it is not, you know, people, they should really fight back by, like, going back to the basic, you know. Like, you hardly see people, I mean, houses out there that have clothesline in the back because they don't do that anymore. I mean, everything is complicated nowadays. Everything is electronic, digital, etc. And I think that's what making people lives complicated. What do you think of that?
Well, turn off your radio. Turn your radio back on. I'll let Bob talk to you. Well, one of the things I'm reminded. Well, I'll let Bob answer first. Go ahead, Bob.
Okay, Dave.
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard that. I agree completely with the man's complaints, and that is what we all are recognizing with the collapse of the mythic stage from 1977 to 1990. We are seeing the disservices of the media environments, the electronic age, and that's why everybody. Is, and that's one of the satirical levels of Bosmian ecology, is that everybody is ready to drop media consumption because they can see the form and the obsolescence of the content. So everybody privately feels the need to have a media ecology. This is, I can see it in all kinds of walks of life, the way people talk, the resentment. I mean, the whole 1992 thing was a resentment against the poltergeist in the election. So media ecology is trendy, as Stang would say. It is something that people feel affinity for. They see the pattern. We've come to that point in our evolution. And now what do we do about it? The thing is that television is the most powerful, the most comprehensive medium that we can make until about 200 years from now, where we're going to go into another dimension. But within the electric age, television is the most synesthetic. It involves all the senses. It is the most aesthetic accomplishment to make as a technology for society. It moves society into highest decibels. It's like putting everybody on Terrence McKenna's MDA or DMA or any one of those drugs he favors. The thing is that what do you do when the society's on it for 30 years? It goes crazy. It gets complicated. Everybody's hallucinating. So our strategy now, yes, is to turn off television for a while so that we can get back into the radio era and see this, the services of a pre-TV era. The problem is that TV saved us from the radio era. So we have to realize the services of television, and we corporately bring it back in. Now, how do whole societies orchestrate this? Well, they develop a global ESP under my guidance, which is, in simple terms, complex clairvoyance or complex clairaudience. So following my guidance, I think I could orchestrate a collective preference, a collective consciousness about when to turn on the TV environment and when to turn it off. So go ahead, privately, don't consume. But you can't stop the forces of nature, which media are. They're forces of nature. It's human-made nature, but they are forces. They're staying here. But we can orchestrate them.
That's true. You know, someone remarked that now that people have their own private TV studio, you know, the camcorder, the portable television studio,
yeah.
It's no wonder that a TV actor became president.
Yeah, but what happened? Why did Clinton become president? Why is George Bush only the interval?
Because
is
Bush it, was. Wait a minute, I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why.
Interactive
because,
president.
Because
he is miming the ground of virtual reality, of interactive TV, which is what people are involved in with now. And part of having interactive TV is having access, miniaturization of a TV studio.
Well, it's also Bush didn't have any. Well, Reagan had a concept of how to use TV, and Bush didn't, and Clinton did.
Well, Bush was. Remember, Reagan is from the period 1977. To 1990, during the mythic stage, and he represented the mythic stage of tactility, how the Secret Council of Ten ran society with a humorous indifference and what Croker calls a cynical power, and just with a wave. Reagan manifested manipian tactility by the administrators. But that collapsed. That mythic stage collapsed in 1990, and Bush was left with that. And he did not know how to operate in the 1990-2020 lockdown Bob Rule phase of homeopathic retrievals. He didn't know how to go past Reagan, which
well,
was hard.
Wait a minute.
Hard to do.
Well, it's also, I think you're missing something, because Bush, I mean, just looking at the two, and like I say, I only watch C-SPAN because sometimes I watch CNN, but I flip off for the commercials. But I like the non-commercial aspect of C-SPAN. But I watched the two, and I saw Clinton on Arsenio and MTV, and the whole thing is Clinton and Reagan knew how to manipulate TV, and Bush had no idea what it was all about.
Yeah, here's the thing. Reagan would not work now. He knew how to manipulate TV in the early 80s, but that was flipped, and his image suffered a catastrophe symbolized by the Iran-Contra scandal. That was the collapse of the mythic stage situation. Now, Bush tried to run it on Reagan's principle, couldn't work anymore. He didn't have the flexibility of the TV generation, so he being a radio era man, he didn't have the flexibility of being interactive. So he tried to involve everybody with the slogan New World Order, but he didn't know how to create the effect of it. So Clinton is naturally able to manipulate TV, but he's manipulating more of that because a lot of the people don't listen to mass media TV anymore. They're into the talk shows, the Rush Limbaughs. And on that level, Rush Limbaugh is destroying Clinton's image. But
Although,
Clinton himself knows how to go around and interact in his town hall meetings and sort of replay the parole model.
Wait a minute. Talk radio is only one part of the spectrum.
That's right.
Because, you can tell even the C-SPAN callers, you can tell it's so slanted, it's so ridiculous. By the way, I want to go to something on this, because speaking of the way media handles things, now, the Iran-Contra report comes out. Now, if you were lucky, you saw the entire Lawrence Walsh press conference.
You mean the recent one?
The one that this week, where he basically debunked everything that was said by Reagan and Bush and Meese and Weinberger, and yet it's those four.
Yeah, I was at that press conference.
It was those four. You're the one who was causing all the feedback, huh?
Yes.
It was those four who have been getting all the media attention. And Walsh is sort of, even Ted Koppel was trying to make him look silly and insignificant. Now, my personal feeling is that Walsh is going to outlast those four bozos by a long shot.
For the mythic stage of written history, he will. But see, Walsh is the latest version of Furry Lent. He's somebody who has something to say, to tell us. And he doesn't know that there's
yes.
no audience there for what he has to offer. As Marshall McLuhan used to say in argument with people, you're trying to tell me something.
Well, here, I'm going to have someone tell you something. I'm going to take letter H because these are very out of order, but I'm just going to try and get to it. Okay, you're on the air. You're the lucky one.
Oh, thank you. Hi, Bob. Thanks for being back on the show, and David Porter for having the hippest show on KPFK.
Write letters.
Yes, we will. We will. I wanted to ask you, Bob, that I'm surprised you being the having all this media business under your hat and understanding what it is and having it under your finger, that you haven't addressed the media punditry of Wild Bill Cooper, UFO outlaw. And Bill Cooper, he has a radio show on shortwave, 5.810, from Monday through Friday, from 9 to 10 Pacific time. And I don't know if you've heard him or not, but I have a little sound bite that I'd like you to hear. So here goes.
Okay, if you look at the people today as far as education, they say that there's like a third of us that are illiterate. Why are we illiterate? Because I believe they purposely have made us this way.
How can they make us this way unless you agree to... Wait a minute, hold it.
Protestant schools.
Wait a minute. It has nothing to do with Protestant schools. It has something to do with parents who don't go down to the school to see what their kids are being taught and don't give a damn anyway, because if they did, they'd pull them out of those stinking schools and teach them at home or put them in a school that would teach them. It's called responsibility.
I agree with you, Bill, but also yourself. You went to a Japanese high school, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, you know yourself that they're more strict. You can't get away with the things like American kids can get away with. And it's not only that, it's what you're being taught.
But you don't understand, my friend.
And everything, I mean, you know...
Whoa. They wouldn't be taught that if the Japanese people were not responsible to ensure that it was being done. Americans just don't give a shit.
And now that you respond, Paul.
I wish you hadn't. Look, you know, you should have censored that caller. God damn it, they're going to get me thrown off the air. Okay. You're on, Bob.
Okay, was that the Robert Anton Wilson again?
No, that was someone else who's trying to get my show in trouble.
Yeah, after he complimented you.
Yeah,
that's a
lot,
like a
Joker.
Tetrad management strategy.
Clown.
Compliment and then kick you.
Well, it must be a Republican.
Okay, now the thing is that Bill Cooper was you know, a lower down conduit for Secret Council 10 actions in the late 70s, early 80s, and I gave him the different disinformation that he had to spread around in the late 80s. And Cooper is helping the Tom Touche faction of Secret Council 10, my antagonist, to create a paranoia about the imminent contact with extraterrestrial situations by projecting that it's already been happening and there's been technology transfers. Not true at all. That's not what's going to happen. Now, Cooper, in his talk there on his show about education, is so, you know, backwards. He's arguing about education in alphabetic education.
And his caller is complaining about another version of the content of education. And he's and Cooper's taking the electric autonomous stance of withdraw your kids, which you can now, and educate them on them within the privacy of your own home and the way you want to direct the content. The thing is, television satellites are massive teaching machines that are altering anybody, and any strategy to retrieve visual space or the American curriculum as it was presented, say, before 1966, is not going to work. That's the problem with LaRouche. He doesn't understand that other half-truth that Marshall emphasizes. So that here is Cooper arguing over an illusion, a virtual reality of education, and he's not talking about the effects of the talk show that he's doing as himself. So the best strategy for any children is to take Finnegan's Wake and show that, and any child can read Finnegan's Wake once you show the interplay of forms in it. You see, that is a strategy of media education versus all the problems that the budget has. But of course, President Clinton goes around trying to reform education with their Global 2000 program, and all these efforts are bureaucratic, almost dictatorial, ignoring of the effects of the situation. We are in the most democratic situation, technologically, than humanity has ever been. We have access to everybody, and we're all involved with everybody. And so let's recognize the huge democracy, and we don't have to implement democracy. That's Yeltsin's problem. That was Bush's problem. It'll be Clinton's problem. We don't have to implement democracy. We are incredibly free and interactive right now. Let's recognize it and actually play it down and go back to a bit of dictatorial situation. Turn off TV, go back to radio, have a bit of bureaucratic organization. This is obviously controversial, but what I'm talking about is more than the half-truth. It is a perception of the weather that we're dealing with.
Yeah, have a drink, too, while you're at it. Couple of things here. You know, Charles Ives noticed in 1919 that direct democracy was nearly, if not possible then, nearly possible then, because of the telephone. He realized, you know, you could just pick up the phone and order something, and it was delivered to your door.
That was very perceptive.
Well, he was quite ahead of his time.
Yeah.
There's more ways than one. And also, you know, this is the typical contrast. Here's George Bush. He goes to the supermarket, and wow, there's a barcode scanner there, and it not only can read the thing and tell you what it is, it can even read it if it's a little crumpled up. And now here's Al Gore, just typical generation. I mean, finally, the executive is possibly playing catch-up with the rest of the world. Al Gore gets on the computer network and has one-on-one conversations with people who are on the Internet, live on C-SPAN or any other TV, and it's printed in the newspaper. And here, you can just sit down, you can talk directly to your president of the Senate.
Yep. That should tell you something.
You want to take another call?
Okay.
Okay, hold on. And, well, they're all new calls. You're on the air.
You know, I'm listening to your
Socorrito?
Yeah, this is Zachary.
Hi.
You know, and yesterday morning there was a kind of impasse. You know, KPFK is, how would you say, my identity as an American. And I heard you make some comment about. Anyway, my point is, I hear conflict between the listener and the producers. You know, and KPFK represents, or to my thinking, represents a kind of Philip Wiley. This guy keeps making remarks about Marshall McLuhan. It represents a kind of outsider's observation of our whole entire culture, you know. And when I hear conflict between producers and listeners, I seem to be destroying your own impetus as far as democratic. Consciousness is concerned, and I was wondering what kind of comment, you know, let's face it, this kind of radio is different from the other so-called public, and I was wondering what kind of a comment y'all would say about subjective criticism. What have you got to say about our?
Well, don't go away, because I want to ask you about something. You know, I don't listen to Friday mornings anymore. But, you know, on one hand, conflict is what democracy is all about, because if you didn't have conflict in music, it would be pretty dull music, like Palestrina. If you didn't have conflict in democracy, you'd have a pretty dull society. But, well, do you feel that there's this conflict on this particular radio program?
No, well, you know, you got a little peeved about this fellow using an American word. Huh?
I wouldn't get upset if management wouldn't get all over my backside for him saying it.
Well, then management must not be an alumni of KPFK, because ever since the SYNQ, or the Symbolese Society,
yeah.
I think KPFK has put itself out way out front of all media. And, you know, and I would love to, I'll put it this way, every time KPFK gets jumped on by the institutions that be, or that are status quo, I think KPFK has won, some kind of award. You know, that's my interpretation. I love all the producers and all the listeners, even Mr. Fabulous Buckley. You know, and for us to be not opening up a can of
that's not easy to do.
You know, for us not to be opening up cans every time we get a chance, as far as intellect and media is concerned, we are defeating our own purpose.
Well, it's kind of hard to be a producer when you're feeling that the station management, and particularly the national board, keeps wussing out on you a lot.
I'd like to hear what this guy, your guest has to say.
Okay, thanks, Acarito. Oops. And you're on, Bob.
Okay, dude, what's his name?
Acarito.
Acarito. Yeah, he called before, right?
Right.
Previous shows.
Yeah.
All right, glad to have him back. Now, his expression of delight and commitment and appreciation for KPFK is a prime example of mythic stage. For him, KPFK is a mythic stage that he wants to be involved in, that he will wear. There's a whole technology of service there for him. There's these people coming in, volunteers, providing programming, and there's a bureaucracy there, and all the stuff that goes to make KPFK, one little media outlet, be an environment for him. He is like a king in relation to all these slaves working for him.
By the way, this is KPFK Los Angeles. Now we're legal.
Okay. Now, but also those slaves, the workers like yourself at KPFK, are kings in other situations. You're a king for all the people at C-SPAN who provide that service for you.
What, is this every man a king?
Yes. Every person is a king and a slave at the same time. We are emperor cum jester, every one of us.
Clinton is quoted in the New Yorker. By the way, people, get the current New Yorker, the one with a letter from Washington in it, with the cover of the raccoon stalking the lady walking her dog, because Clinton said the White House is probably the fanciest prison in the United States.
That's true. Now, that's appropriate to what we're saying, is that any job, any role that you keep for more than 6 months will become a prison. So the station managers of KPFK will suffer the problems of having a role. We have access to so many roles via putting on different media and the services and the masks they offer, KPFK just being one of them, that any bureaucrat will become frustrated after 6 to 12 months and actually turn into a resentful, dictatorial situation. So because there's a bureaucracy in most institutions, that'll happen. And so this person is complaining about one aspect, one necessary aspect within the service environment of KPFK, because KPFK is so tiny compared to the FCC and the other bureaucracies that have to keep their mythic stage going, that your station managers have to respond to, let's say the right-wing mood in America that's happened in the 80s and I guess happening now. Your management has to respond to that, or are infiltrated in there, and you as programmers, Dave, have to respond to that. And so there is really an impossibility to deal with it. I mean, you're not going to throw KPFK open to the listeners like it was in the 60s where anybody could walk in, because it's such a tiny medium. So Acarita has to realize that his dedication to that mythic stage should not be so. If it fills him with frustration, he should move over and learn to appreciate other mythic stages, other media, because KPFK is not democratic in the sense of the solar theater. This world we're in is the most democratic situation by the services provided. But when you bring in the anthropomorphic bureaucratic, that tiny little human being level, which it doesn't really exist on the interplay of all media, then it appears to be bureaucratic, but it's not even that. It's nothing. It's disappeared. KPFK does not exist. It's a virtual reality.
Well, actually, you know, KPFK doesn't exist as well as some of the equipment here. The cassette machine just did a funny on me. It jumped from record to play, so I hope someone else is taping this, because there's about 30 seconds of your comments that I have just missed from the official copy, and I hope somebody can maybe provide it with me. It's just like within the last 2 or 3 minutes.
Now, I'm not denigrating Acarita's involvement with KPFK or any of the listeners, but they have to, if he is frustrated, maybe he isn't. He just wanted to get on the air and talk about something. I mean, even our frustrations are ephemeral and passing. We go, it's like Alice in Wonderland. She can't remember who she was in the morning, in the afternoon. You know, it's just we become many selves. We all contain multitudes, and many selves and many collective selves through the mythic stages, the environments we use. So I never take anybody's grievance too seriously, and
I wouldn't take his point or your point too seriously, though I have compassion in terms of trying to give the larger pattern we're operating in.
Well, you say you're not a homeopathic retrieval, but I know you are. Let's take another call. You're the lucky one. You're on the air. Well, no, you're not. You're on the air.
Yeah, I did call earlier, asking the question about, at least for Venice, where's Mark, and I asked her to talk about the Media Fest as well as Sitting His Wake, and then the next two calls were essentially about the Media Fest. And what I perceive from Bob as being his statement, he can correct me when he responds, is that there's basically a waterfall of media that we've been tumulted with at the end of the mythic stage that would have ended in 1990. And we need to step outside of it and form our own media ecology through that fast and work through our own exclusion and inclusion of media and various retrievals of different forms like radio, music, art. Those things allow us to form our own media ecologies. And how does he propose that how do we say that he says that people develop their own face or discarnation on a daily level? How do they tune in and affect other people without, you know, becoming subject to the retrieval system of the pinks?
Well, I normally don't like to take second callers, but make it fast, Bob, so I can go on to another original caller.
No, that's a very good question. I mean, you know, this guy is taking what I'm saying relatively seriously, and he's pursuing the discussion, right?
Yeah, but I'd like to, I have a thing about people calling back when I can't get to all the people who are calling the first time.
Right, okay, I'll just try to say that the post-1990 phase is electric autonomy. We're all, even beyond being satellited minds, the image on CNN of the satellite moving in on the planet and circling the planet, that's what we all were from 1977 to 1990. Now we have gone past the satellite and gone into a situation, it's very hard to say what we're wearing right now. The privatizing of that is virtual reality, so that media ecology is a privatized hologram. Now, he's saying a lot of the situation is that the solution is in the problem. And so by him stating that question, it's more important than the answer. He just has to realize that the answer is that you are in a state of media conditioning, and the pinks are going to carry on with their retrievals, and we can carry on with our subgenius retrievals in any form we want. This is the amazing democracy of our situation. Nobody has to listen to anybody else. Nobody has to communicate. At the same time, you can interpenetrate and communicate with ever who you want. So it's a paradoxical situation where you are both figure and ground.
Okay, let's go on to another call. Hold on. And you're the lucky one.
Hello?
Hello.
Oh, hi. My question for Bob is, who is Kerry Thornley, and what is his connection to the Church of the Subgenius in Dallas and to the JFK assassination?
Kerry Thornley?
Yes.
Okay, hold on. I'll take your call. Go ahead.
Okay, Kerry Thornley?
That's right.
Kerry Thornley was a good friend of our first caller, the Robert Anton Wilson, and they started the Discordians. But because the Discordians were interested in the JFK assassination, Kerry Thornley got involved with Jim Garrison, and they became enemies. Garrison did not respond favorably to Thornley. Now, Thornley did have his personal experience of involvement with Lee Harvey Oswald, and as I said before, I've been involved in the cover-up of the JFK assassination. I know exactly Lee Harvey Oswald's role, and Kerry Thornley is mistaken about the mind control interpretation that he thought he and Lee went through. That did not happen. Walter Bower's book, Operation Mind Control, is erroneous on the point of the hypnotism of Lee Harvey Oswald. It is accurate about the hypnotism of Sirhan Sirhan. But what happened with Kerry Thornley is totally his own delusion. And people like that end up in Reverend Stang's Church of Subgenius because they're cynical, they're manipian, and don't know the hidden satellite environment that makes them that way. So Kerry Thornley is a funny person, sort of condemned to living in that little mythic stage of the Church of Subgenius and Robert Anton Wilson devotees, or people who escaped from Robert Anton Wilson. Kerry Thornley is not important for Tetrad management, but he's important to himself, and that's good. May he live forever.
By the way, now that you remind me of that show where Nid got you dead to rights on your involvement in the Kennedy cover-up,
You know, there's someone impersonating
you. Was that Ned who called?
No, but that was Ned who, I'm referring back to the call
right.
where Ned asked the original question. But, you know, there's someone impersonating you.
Well, yeah,
there's someone impersonating,
but who are you thinking of?
Well, according to one of my operatives, this person operating you, if they were involved in the Kennedy assassination, they must have been a gangbanger going around on a tricycle.
Oh, that's what's his name, Bill Mitchell. The guy, he met me on the beach. I don't know, maybe it was in July, 93 when I was passing through L.A. and I was just there for a few weeks and Monk magazine celebrated that. They declared the fact that Bob Dobbs lives here makes L.A. one of the most amazing places to exist. So Bill Mitchell met me. But of course, thanks to Joe Dunstone's D-cell, I look like I'm 32 or maybe even 28. He thinks I'm this young person, 35, who therefore must have been on a tricycle in 63. He doesn't realize I'll be 72 in a week or so on February 2nd. I was born in 1922. And that's my objection to Bill Mitchell's interpretation of me. He doesn't know how healthy I am.
Well, he's from Chicago, what you say. Okay, let's go to another
call. That's
right,
Sherman Skolnick, you know, the old Rockefeller enclave. I mean, Bill Mitchell does end up arguing a lot with the Rockefeller Combine, which is such a tiny mythic stage now. We can actually thank the Rockefellers for the part of the global theater they built.
You know, that's why he's it's hilarious to hear Newt Gingrich calling Bill Clinton a secret socialist with counterculture values, and then hearing Bill Mitchell attacking Clinton for being part of the Rockefeller cabal. You know, I feel like I'm in between two rocks and two hard places.
Yeah, you feel like you're inside Finnegan's Wake. Jim and Sean, you know, mirror images of each other, and it's very easy to bypass that confusion. But Bill Mitchell, you know, thank me that he's been working in a particular May Brussels zone or post May Brussels zone, and he does create incredible information, but he's like a furry lint. He has to realize the larger implications, which we all can realize collectively and form a collective consciousness, way past the Jungian and Joseph Campbell archetypes.
Okay, well, I'm going to go to another call, and also I'm going to clear the way here so the next programmer can come in and start setting up. So I'm going to put you on hold. And, boy, we got another five callers. I hope you people call during the fun drive or at least write letters about how brilliant this program is. Let's see. Okay, let's take B. You're on the air.
Yo, good morning, finally. Is that Bob Dobbs back there, huh?
Well, he's listening.
I know he's listening. Bill, this is a great program. I happen to also agree
no, this
with
is
Bob
Dave.
Dobbs about the media ecology. I think that's one of the best things that can happen in this part of the last days of the millennium here, that we get rid of the mixed corporate media for a while and get back to truth, justice, and righteousness, the principles of Ma'at, the ancient principles of the ancient Nile civilizations, that gave rise to all of this so-called philosophy of Aristotle and Plato, these cave dwellers who didn't even know what they were studying in ancient Kemet. And once we do that, we can get down with some solid truth, and then we can proceed to be the kinds of human beings that we're supposed to be and not these backward ignoramuses that go around pretending like they know and understand language that they never even understood in the first place.
Okay, comment?
Okay, that's my friend Tariq. Are you there, Dave?
I'm here. I'm waiting for the next programmer to come in when I turn my microphone off.
Okay, we're on?
Any comment, yeah?
Yeah, that's my friend Tariq, who was on the beach with me around the time I met Bill Mitchell in the last summer. Tariq always emphasizes the mythic stage and roots of Africa. I myself am a African-American woman. I'm a black woman myself. If you meet me in person, Bill Mitchell didn't notice that. But in person,
no, he thought you'd be about 40
woman.
Years old.
And I recognize the roots that Tariq is talking about. And Tariq recognizes, as he's told me, he understands the concept of the solar government. I think Tariq still has to work on the universal government and the mythic stage government phases up till 1990. But at least he's making the effort on the solar government phase, which is from 1945 to 1960. The thing is that he recognizes that we are not in an anthropomorphic, any culturally based situation as long as we have this mixed corporate media bombardment.
I mean, media, our culture, we got to recognize that's our new culture, but we're not prepared to swim in this water without retrieving our roots. And therefore, we have to stop the FDA and the censoring of herbs and these ancient modalities that help us and are have no chance under the stress of the satellite environment. As an aside, I would point out that the L.A. earthquake was caused by the satellite environment. When you have a whole generation, or a whole 5 billion people inside the psychic echo chamber, to quote Frank's Lumpy Gravy, inside the drum of the satellite environment, that creates such an effect on nature and us, and we are part of nature, that nature has a heart attack, and that's what's coming as long as we have a satellite environment. So we may perhaps advocate, after TV media ecology, satellite media ecology. Let's turn off the satellite environment. So
wait a minute.
I commend Tariq for recommending and realizing that media ecology is the last lost cause.
Well, actually, you know, I heard something else. I was enjoying some fine spirits over the week, and I just for laughs I turned on the CBN News channel, and there was a former presidential candidate Pat Robertson, and he said the reason the LA earthquake happened was because God had lifted His hand of protection from this great nation, because we are turning away from God and encouraging adultery, incest, and homosexuality.
Well, that's a fine example of the user as the content. That's one mythic stage. That Christian fundamentalist mythic stage interacting with all the other mythic stages inside the fact the word makes the market, which is illustrated in my video, Everything's Disappeared. The word is Dan Rather, the mixed corporate media. They create the pressure, and all mythic stages interpret that pressure.
Speaking of markets, Pat was using it to encourage people to call up and give him all their money. Let's go to another call. Hold on. And you're the lucky one.
Hello?
Hello.
Yeah. The media is controlled by the capitalist ruling class to pacify the workers, and I think we need a Marxist-Leninist revolution.
Well, okay, except I think Marxism is about as outdated as Adam Smith. Comment, Bob?
Yeah, this caller has to read Baudrillard. He talks about In the Shadow of the Silent Majorities and how the revolutionary act of the workers, who are what the media is an extension of. I mean, the owners do not run the media environment. They run some of the content, but they do not run the effects of the interplay of them. So the people created, these are, television satellites are an extension of all humanity. So the workers made this environment, and we have to realize the situation we're in. But as Baudrillard, Jean Baudrillard states in his book Baudrillard Live, you can see a collection of interviews by Mike Gane, G-A-N-E. You can see how he used McLuhan through the 80s in his interviews to explain how the silent majority hides behind the mixed corporate media as manipian satirists of the Poltergeist, and this appeared in Extreme in 1992 during the election, how the audience satirized the pollsters and were not able to be accurately portrayed by the pollsters. The working class instinctively knows how to use the media. They hide behind the mixed corporate media, which is a great strategy because it prevents any kind of militaristic right-wing, left-wing agenda. No bureaucratic agenda can be accomplished in the mixed corporate media, canceling out of everything. It's manipian text. It'll be characteristic. And so I recommend this person study Baudrillard and understand why his analysis is accurately repudiated by Dave Porter.
You know, it's funny, the right-wingers, the Rush Limbaugh crowd and all that, and the Ray Breen crowd and all those people, they do seem to create their own environment, because they're certainly active in keeping it going. You know, speaking of Marxist revolution, now we all remember that wonderfully informative 1992 Republican convention where I think it was Rich Bond said that we're America and everyone else is not. I mean, it was such an inclusive big tent. Well, here's something I want to tell you about. The same thing's happening to the Peace and Freedom Party. Because a year ago, the New Alliance Party, the New Alliance Party, the Fulani organization, they were working with the Peace and Freedom Party. And, in fact, they were the ones who did most of the work to help me get on the ballot as a Peace and Freedom Party candidate. My own party basically walked out on me. they recently repudiated the Peace and Freedom Party, and they disavowed, you know, they said, we're not going to work with you people anymore because you're a bunch of obstructionists and dinosaurs. And the PNF dinosaurs are dancing in the street, snapping their fingers, clicking their heels. I think it's the greatest thing. Of course, this is the same party that has a bunch of trots in it who say when the revolution comes, you people who aren't us, we're going to take you out and shoot you. You know, I mean, it's like two north ends on two magnets. They're both north ends. That's why they repel. That's why Trots and Republicans don't get along.
They're tribal. It's tribal polarity.
Anyway, that's the hot
we
thing.
Only got a few minutes. Could you check to see if Dave Wurster's there? It's always good to have Dave Wurster. I don't want to disconnect callers, but is there a way of seeing if he's there?
No, and besides, okay. If he got on, he'd take every one of these last minutes.
Okay.
Hold on. Let me just take a random caller. You're on the air. Hello.
Oh, hello. Good morning. I'm Heather Probst, daughter of Steve Probst.
Yeah.
And I have one question for Mr. Dodd. What does he have to do with the band Devo?
Is that it?
Yes.
Okay, turn on your radio and listen. What do you got to do with Devo?
Who is she the daughter of?
Steve Probst is one of my semi-regular guests, and he brings in the R&B and oldies.
Yeah, Jerry Fialka told me a lot about him.
Yeah, he's cool.
Yeah, he's an authority on the 40s, 50s, I guess. And
so what do you have to do with Devo?
She's the daughter of Steve Probst who called in, right?
Yeah.
Is she the daughter of Probst?
Yes, yes.
Okay, and she wants to know what I have to do with Devo?
Yes.
Well, Devo was indirectly involved with me with Mark Mothersbaugh's fascination with Reverend Stang's Church of the Subgenius. I mean, he was an early member of Stang's mythic stage, and so since that mythic stage was an interpretation of me, then Devo was enthusiastic about me. But the only involvement I had with Devo was in October, November 1977 when Matt Graney and I were together at his home where he lived when life was hell for him, when he worked at the Xerox company and that situation that inspired his cartoon. And he played me an early tape of Devo. And so since electric media is reality, that was my direct involvement with Devo, and that's as far as it got. So Devo, the meaning of Devo, if it means devolution, is an appropriate term as an acronym or a slogan to refer to the new dark ages that we move into under the excessive implosion of mixed corporate media. So it's an appropriate title. It had pitch, perfect pitch for its time. But Matt Groening, I should say, did not know who I was when I was with him in 1977.
No, you were a gangbanger on a tricycle at the time.
Yeah.
Let's go to another call. Hold on. You're the lucky one.
Yes. You mentioning communism, I will remind everybody out there
Dennis.
That 6 months ago the people of Poland voted in an election, voted the Communist Party into power. Goodbye.
That's very true. Yeah, of course, Dennis is a caller here. I remember once fondly that Dennis called into the movie theater program, and he said, I don't have my teeth in. And the host responded, well, movies don't have any teeth in them. Why should you?
Yeah, the alphabet is the extension of our teeth. Okay.
Okay, let's go to another caller. Hold on.
No, Dave, what did she say?
Oh, he.
Or he. I didn't catch that. Tell me. It sounded interesting.
Well, I forgot already.
Was that about communism and exploded?
The people of Poland and the people in Russia are voting communists back in.
Oh, that's part of the 1990-2020 thing I outlined in my liner notes of the discontinuous homeopathic retrievals. There's going to be retrievals of all mythic stages. And that's what another thing Bush didn't know on his low-level version of tetrad management.
Yeah,
so it's no surprise, and Frank Zappa predicted this, that communism would come back in various forms. Just like what would be a retrieval? There'll be a retrieval of the Victorian era.
By the way,
tiny retrieval.
I want to ask you something. Have you heard the program that comes on after this?
No, me?
Yes.
No.
Have you never heard it when you've been staying in Venice?
No, I didn't.
Heartfelt music with John Davis?
The people I was involved with always turn it off. They were so overwhelmed by your show.
Oh, well, I was just wondering. I don't know if you know this, but, you know, we have a folk music program called Heartfelt Music. I was wondering, do you have any speculation as to what this program would be a homeopathic retrieval of?
Yours or the one following?
The one following.
Well, that's a homeopathic retrieval of the 4th Street in Greenwich Village. Buzz Linehart.
Buzz Linehart?
And Bob Fass at WBAI. I mean, in New York, he plays that kind of stuff every Thursday night. Unnameable Radio or Radio Unnameable. It's all a retrieval of that period that Theodore Bacall and Odette were part of, and they were friends of Herb Cohen, the guy who ripped off Frank Zappa. Let's make a tribute to him, as we think of Frank, a counter-irritant kind of tribute. But it's all a retrieval of Positively 4th Street.
in the village, right?
Okay, I'm going to take one more call. Hold on. And you're our last call for the morning.
Yes, good morning, sir. I've been listening to the radio since 7 o'clock this morning, and I've been listening to a very interesting program, but I don't really know what it's all about. I hear a man saying, I turned it on when a man said, I'm going to have an interview with Frank Zappa in 2 years. And then another man called and he said, you're talking to a black woman. And is he a man, a woman? And what does holistic music mean? I'm confused, but it's interesting. Thank you.
And thank you. Final comments?
Well, that's a very perceptive interpretation, a very honest interpretation of the effect of me and Tetrad Management. Did he say the phrase holistic music?
Yeah, I think he mistook homeopathic retrieval for holistic music.
Well, the thing is, what this show is about is Who's Forgotten Furry Lint. That's what it's about. And it's within the context of hand signals for the blind. But it's about, you know, your ears may not believe it, it's about the person who controls this global theater. And I don't control it in a dictatorial George Bush sense. I control it through jujitsu. So this person is talking to the most aware, most conscious person and listening for an hour and a half. And, of course, if you are aware, then you're a chameleon because the mixed corporate media and the manipulative tactility of it puts people, all of us, through many changes of form and shape and desire. Then I have to manifest this as part of my satire. Not that the satire is not based on real science. I don't mean to be arbitrary in my satire. Satire, it's like McLuhan used to say, humor is part of learning. When you're laughing, you're learning. So I have to mime the environment that I'm describing.
Well, they used to say
to Ronald Reagan, in press conferences on shortwave radio, they actually have on record that he was asked if he's a woman, and he said yes.
Well, Bob, it's been an interesting morning. Thank you very much. I'm glad we didn't have to chase you around the globe too much with these 5 or 7 or 13 different phone numbers I have for you. We're going to be back. Now, the fund drive is from February 24th to March 11th, Friday. And Bob is scheduled to be back on March 12th. Well, we'll hold our breath on that. The way fund drives have been going around here is we have to extend them another 36 years. So hopefully Bob will be back on March 12th. If we can't do listener phone calls, I'll have you on after the next hour of Who's Forgotten Furry Lint from 7 to 7:30, and then someone else will come in here and they'll ask people to give us money so we can keep Bob on the air, keep me on the air, keep John Davis on the air, keep John Chartrand on the air. By the way, if you haven't a definition of obscenity, there's a number here for John Chartrand's songs program. I don't have it with me, but maybe someone can call. Can tell you later on in the week if you call up the switchboard at 985-2711.
And let's call.
This is a quotation from Dr. John Lilly. In the province of the mind, that which one believes to be true either is true or becomes true within certain limitations. These limitations are to be explored experientially and experimentally. And once discovered are further limitations to be transcended. In the province of the mind, there are no limitations. In the province of the body, this is not a direct quote, there are certain limitations that you will discover them when you get to them. You need not project them in advance. They will reveal themselves, you know, at that point when you arrive, and some of them you cannot transcend. But you also should not, like, plot them out in advance. They're far lesser than you might imagine. Okay? Here we go.
Right, and was that the first time you ever heard it?
No, I had heard it before. He's been on several times, and I had picked up one of his other shows with Royal Hollywood. Or, I'm sorry, with David Porter.
David Porter. And what intrigued you about the show?
Well, just the overall content, the interest in the mixed media, things like that, and I'd like to pursue.
Great. What in particular about the content? What specifically?
Well, it's hard to say anything specific. It's just the whole gestalt.
I see. Okay. Well, do you have a paper or pencil?
I sure do. Some CDs out?
He has two CDs there under the name Producers for Bob. You'll get all that information in the literature I send you.
Okay, and there'll be an order sheet for that.
Right.
Fantastic. And you need a stamp self-addressed envelope.
That'll do it.
Fantastic. That's what I need to know.
Yeah. So tell me, why do you...